Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. After 20 months of grueling negotiations, on July 14th, Iran reached a long-term nuclear deal with the P5 plus one group of world powers, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, China, and Russia plus Germany. Iran has agreed to limit its nuclear activities in return for the lifting of crippling sanctions. Since this historic deal was reached, much of the public debate and analysis has revolved around the geopolitics of the agreement, what the deal means for the future of U.S.-Iran relations, and whether Republicans in the U.S. and hardliners in Iran will be able to sabotage the deal. Reports also focus on the role the Israeli lobby will play to influence the final vote in Congress, which is set for September 20th. The New York Times recently reported that AIPAC, Washington's most influential pro-Israel lobby, reportedly plans to spend $20 million over the next 2 months urging Congress to vote against the deal. As part of its efforts to kill the agreement, AIPAC launched a 501c4 advocacy group called Citizens for a Nuclear-Free Iran. The group, according to the New York Times, was, quote, formed with the sole mission of educating the public about the dangers of the proposed Iran deal, end quote. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about the specifics of the deal. Will opponents succeed in unraveling months of negotiations? What does this deal and the lifting of the sanctions mean for the Iranian people? Today we're joined by Mansour Farhang. He's Professor Emeritus of International Relations at Bennington College in Vermont, and he joins us on the phone from New York. Hi, Mansour. Good to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Hadi Rami. He's Executive Director of the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran. This is one of the leading groups reporting and documenting human rights violations in Iran and building international coalitions in defense of Iranian human rights defenders. And Hadi also joins us from New York. Hi, Hadi. Welcome to the show.
Good morning to you, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So this historic deal has generated so much reaction. It's now actually back in the headlines. Washington and Tehran have both called the deal a win-win for both countries. Secretary John Kerry has repeatedly said that this deal is the best the U.S. could have gotten. He told the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee that there was no unicorn or fantasy deal that could be a better alternative. So, Mansour, what are your thoughts on this? Is there any going back, or is this a done deal?
I hope it is a done deal, because I cannot think of an alternative that would, by any means, make a contribution to peace, tranquility, or relaxation of this tension and confrontation between the United States and Iran. This deal, if we use the standards contained in non-proliferation treaty, this deal imposes restrictions on Iran's nuclear infrastructure in an unprecedented fashion. There is no other signatory to the non-proliferation treaty that has submitted to these restrictions, and this is because of Iran's behavior over the past 30-some years, particularly during the 8 years of President Ahmadinejad, created an international consensus concerning Iran's threat to regional security, and that international consensus that included both Russia and China, as well as European Union, managed to pursue these negotiations in such a way that Iran's nuclear program, or at least the perceived threat of the program, is contained at least for the next 15 years. However, since the Bush administration, the neocons in this country wanted to completely demolish Iran's nuclear infrastructure and say that Iran should not have the capacity to enrich uranium at all. If that is the standard, then it was a compromise deal in such a way that the basic rights of Iran as a signatory to the non-proliferation treaty to enrich uranium in a minimal way, that is having no more than 5,000 centrifuges and in a very low-quality machinery, and also exporting all of its enriched uranium at all kinds of limitations and heavy body reactor and so forth. So this is really an accomplishment for a threat, for a problem that could lead to another disastrous war in the Middle East.
And we'll talk about the specific details in just a minute. But Hadi, what are your thoughts overall? Is this a done deal?
Well, first of all, I want to echo Mansour's point and say that this is a very welcome development. But it is not a done deal yet, because we know that U.S. Congress still has time to review this and take a vote on it, and President Obama has to work very hard to ensure a veto-proof support in the Congress. And the Iranian hardliners are waiting to see what the American Congress is going to do. So till September 20th, it won't be a done deal. But all signs are that it could be a done deal, and it is certainly very much welcomed in Iran by the general population and even by dissidents and opponents of the regime inside the country, because they see this as a very important opening and a step forward first of all, remove the shadow of war and destruction facing them. Secondly, end the devastating sanctions that have crippled the entire society and have made many concerns that if the social and economic fabric of the society is destroyed through these sanctions, then it would be very hard to rebuild civil society and have and advocate for civil liberties. And finally, it is really a major step to hopefully end 35 years of confrontation between Iran and U.S. that has been used by hardliners inside the country to justify their repression. Now they're not going to have an excuse to continue the repression that has been gripping the country. So on all fronts, we see this as a very hopeful and positive sign and step forward, but we have to ensure that the deal is not killed by its opponents in Washington and Tehran.
And because so much of the media in the U.S. have focused specifically on the opponents, I think in the days after the deal was reached, I heard almost every single news outlet interview Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And as I said in the introduction, the New York Times is reporting that AIPAC plans to spend about $20 million trying to urge members of Congress to vote against the deal. So because the opponents have gotten so much attention and the Iranian people have not really gotten as much attention, that's an understatement, I wanted to talk a bit about the report that you conducted with the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran, interviewed a number of political activists, filmmakers, professors, to talk about what their thoughts on this deal. And Time magazine had a nice piece on the outcome, and I just wanted to read a couple of quotes. A journalist in Tehran and former political prisoner who wanted to remain anonymous said, quote, "An agreement will have its first impact on society's collective mental state. While many predict this might be short-lived, the psychological impact of this victory in the different sectors of the society will definitely not be short-lived. Such a positive impact can even move people to take action to improve their conditions." Another quote by Masoud Shaifi, a lawyer, says, "If the sanctions are lifted, another impact, I believe, would be a big opening in the human rights discourse. The human rights issue, God willing, will find more flexibility after this agreement. If the nuclear issue is resolved, many other issues will be influenced." Hadi, what really struck you about the responses you got to the nuclear deal?
Yes, what is really striking is the unanimous support among people who are advocating for civil liberties in Iran and are not happy with the situation in the country. They have consistently argued that ever since the nuclear issue became dominant in 2003, all venues for domestic reform have been closing inside Iran, and it has been very hard to advocate and organize for such demands. And for the past 12 years, they've paid a very heavy price, and it has been used as a justification for repression. So they see it as a window of opportunity. And the other thing that struck me is the sense that under 8 years of Ahmadinejad, the entire country seems to have fallen into a collective depression and loss of hope. So the first quote you read about lifting of their spirits and giving them hope is something that they find essential, that there is light at the end of tunnel. And now they can have more hope for their future. Really, Iran is a very young country, sophisticated, educated, and the youth there are looking for every opportunity to pursue their hopes and dreams. And under the past 10 years, between domestic repression and international pressure and sanctions, they've seen every door closed on them in pursuing opportunities or holding their government accountable. And ending that tension on the foreign relations stage seems to be very essential for them, and opening the gates for them to be reintegrated with the international community.
And Mansour, what would you add to that? What are you hearing from people inside Iran?
Over the past 37 years, the radical elements in control of the Iranian state have used confrontation with the West and now the nuclear issue as a justification to oppress and contain any dissident activity inside the country. To the extent that, and when I say opposition of the Iranian regime to the West, it is not in a leftist sense, it is not anti-imperialist, it is not based on any notion of justice, but it is opposition to modernity, opposition to progressive socio-cultural values. When it comes to socio-cultural dimension of life, the Iranian regime represents morbidity. So people in Iran want to put an end to this confrontation so that at least one excuse will be taken away from the Iranian regime. The enemy at the gate has been used in order to justify all kinds of repressive measures in Iran. I read Iranian press, I have contact with people inside the country, and I would say the response of the Iranian people, particularly the educated sector of the society to this agreement, is unanimously positive. It doesn't mean that they think it will automatically lead to the achievement of their goals, but it will definitely prepare the way. It will give them an advantage that they have not had, you know, in the past. So overall, I would say this achievement, in addition to issues of security concerning the United States and other states in the Middle East, when it comes to socio-cultural environment of Iran, political aspirations of the Iranian people, an end to this confrontation symbolized by the Vienna Agreement is welcomed by overwhelming majority of the Iranian people in general and educated and political people in particular.
And I wanted to read a few more quotes from this report: High Hopes, Tempered Expectations, Views from Iran on the Nuclear Negotiations. This report was issued by the International Campaign for Human Rights, and Hadi Rami is Executive Director of the International Campaign. And a quote from Mohammed Saleh Nikbat, a lawyer, says, quote, as a defense lawyer for individuals who are pursued or imprisoned for political reasons, my work will be positively impacted and society will enjoy more freedom. Unlike those who believe that a decrease in foreign pressure would increase pressure inside the country, I don't believe this, end quote. And then Hamid Amjad, a playwright, theater director, and publisher in Tehran, said, whether lame or legitimate, I hope that after a nuclear agreement, there are no more excuses and that it would be possible to expect and to demand things. So, Hadi, what are your thoughts? There has been a debate about whether the agreement and the sanctions relief will lead to the lessening of state repression and really open the door to more, political action inside the country. What are your thoughts on that?
Our evaluation is that the nuclear deal is a necessary condition, but not sufficient to improve the situation inside the country. Indeed, there is a debate that even though Rouhani made a lot of promises to focus on civil liberties and improving the domestic situation, it may indeed be the opposite, that the hardliners now are going to be given a free hand by the supreme leader in order to reassert themselves to increase the repression. The other side believes that no, Rouhani is now his entire political survival, especially in light of upcoming parliamentary elections, depends on delivering on his domestic promises, and there are a lot of expectations of that. Again, what our thoughts are is that not having a deal is a definite recipe for continued and increased repression. Having a deal opens a window of opportunity. And it requires now for the international community to press Iran to allow peaceful dissent and end its repression, and it requires Rouhani government to follow on the promises that it made. We do need that space opened up inside Iran for people to advocate and hold Rouhani accountable. So again, we're not sure whether the repression will end, but we do see that window of opportunity. Not having a deal, though, is very clear, would have led to continued repression and reinforcement of hardline policies. And the work is just begun now to pursue civil liberties in Iran. It will not be automatic. The deal by itself doesn't have anything related to that. But really what people are waiting for, like Mansour said, for the past 37 years, they want this excuse the regime has had, or the hardline components of it, that they use the enemy at the gate, especially the U.S., as an excuse for their policies. They hope to see that go away, because the general population doesn't buy the American anti-Americanism anymore, and knows that many problems inside the country have their roots and fundamental issues inside the country, and government policies have to change, and there has to be room for civil society to contribute, that they cannot be silenced indefinitely. And indeed, Rouhani, during his presidential campaign, very well touched on those issues and made promises. And now he doesn't have excuse anymore, if the deal goes through, to say that the nuclear deal and sanctions are the main priority. The main issue is to, again, remove foreign policy tensions and be able to talk about the domestic, pressing domestic issues, something that has not been possible for the past 10 years.
Let me add something to what Hadi said. And this is, the Iranian regime over the past 37 years has produced its own capitalist class. Iran is a rentier state. And we have a new class of over very rich people who want to have normal trade and economic relationship with the Western world. That is to say, they are silent. These are the people within the regime who back up Rouhani and Zarif and other members of the political class in Iran. That is to say, the society has changed, and 70% of the Iranian people are under 40 years old. That is to say, at the time of the revolution, they were babies who were not born yet. Therefore, the regime is really at a fork today. In order to preserve its own interest and respond to the people who have vested economic capital inside the country, they do want to improve relationship with the Western world in an economic and trade sense. This is why it's an opportunity for Western countries, particularly the European Union, that foreign ministers and finance ministers of European countries are going to Iran. They want to make deals. They're interested in Iranian market. Iran is a rich country with respect to its natural resources. It's a very profitable market. So they want to penetrate that market. And that market has suffered from sanctions and economic and political isolation. So I genuinely hope that international human rights organizations, and particularly the European countries, and to the extent possible Obama administration, they, when they want to improve trade and economic relationship with Iran, they set some conditions with respect to improvement in human rights situation, improvement in civil rights situation, and the Iranian regime's absurd and preposterous policy of dividing the Iranian society between insiders and outsiders. So this opportunity, this deal was made because it was necessitated by the conditions of the society. This is the first time in the 37-year history of Iran that the regime made a foreign policy decision which is completely consistent with the national interests of Iran, and the foreign powers, particularly economic, in economic relations and major corporations, should not be disinterested in human rights and internal situation in Iran when they want to make deal and establish new economic relations with the regime, because the regime in that sense is really vulnerable. The regime can be pressured to make compromises in that regard.
Mansour Farhang is Professor Emeritus of International Relations at Bennington College in Vermont, and Hadi Ghami is Executive Director of the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran, one of the leading groups reporting and documenting human rights violations in Iran. Today, we are talking about the historic Iran nuclear deal. It was reached after 20 months of grueling negotiations on July 14th, reached with the U.S., U.K., France, China, Russia, and Germany. Iran has agreed to limit its nuclear activities in return for the lifting of crippling sanctions. We have been bombarded by opponents and reasons why they oppose the deal. What we wanted to do today was talk about what's in the deal and talk about how this actually affects the Iranian people. So what questions do you have about this deal? If you are from Iran, what are your thoughts on this? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's talk about the specific deal. CNN has a piece looking at the seven key points. So, for example, centrifuges, Iran would have to reduce its total of 19,000 centrifuges, 10,000 of which are still spinning today, down to 6,000 under the deal. These are tube-shaped machines used to enrich uranium, the material necessary for nuclear power and nuclear bombs. And then on research and development, Iran can continue its R&D on enrichment, but that work will be limited to keep the country to its breakout time frame of 1 year. Mansour, what else strikes you specifically about the details?
With respect to openness, even though they are not accepting the language, which is completely transparent and clear, but they talk about managed inspection of the facilities that are suspected of having nuclear activities. So in that sense, the Iranian regime has really crumbled, because it's always possible the Iranian regime is like other totalitarian regimes, could be deceptive in its behavior. In fact, the Iranian regime, to the best of my knowledge, is the only country in the world that considers lying or deceiving as a religious duty in pursuit of their goals. They call it taqiyya, which is a notion in Shi'i, you know, Islam. So because of that distrust, it is absolutely essential that International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors have the right in a timely manner to suspect the areas where they might be activities related to nuclear development. This compromise on the part of, you know, Iran shows that the part of this wing of the regime, that faction within the regime that really wants to solve this problem in pursuit of its own economic interest and removal of threat to the stability of the regime, is winning. In other words, I think the regime is genuinely really divided, but those who are supporting the deal are receiving the overwhelming majority of the public, and they're also pursuing their own economic and trade interests. In that sense, I find the deal being somewhat responsive to these needs, and therefore hopeful that it will actually work in the process of implementation.
We're going to take a quick break. Also, according to reports, Iran has spent $100 billion on its nuclear program. And I'd love to ask you both why. That's a lot of money. Why did they do that? What did they get in return? Today, we are talking about the historic Iran nuclear deal. We're talking about the details and how the deal and the lifting of sanctions will affect the Iranian people. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways of participating in the conversation on your call on the telephone by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio or by going to yourcallradio.org, the website. If you'd like to participate in today's show, you may telephone toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Coming up in just a half an hour here on 91.7, it'll be BBC World Have Your Say. The topic will be Africa. Stay tuned.
The This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Rick O'Berry, former flipper trainer turned dolphin activist and star of the Academy Award-winning documentary The Cove. Rick O'Berry's dolphin project works to end the billion-dollar dolphin captivity industry around the globe and to end the killing of dolphins in Taiji, Japan. So how far have we come in creating safety and respect for marine mammals? On Friday, it's our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the Iran nuclear deal. After 20 months of negotiations on July 14th, Iran reached a long-term deal with the U.S., U.K., France, China, Russia, and Germany. Iran has agreed to limit its nuclear activities in return for the lifting of crippling sanctions. Today, we're talking about the details. We're talking about how it will affect the Iranian people. That has unfortunately been missing from most of the media coverage in the United States. And then we're also going to talk about, and Mansoor mentioned this earlier, a business conference that happened in Vienna last week. It was the first event since the deal was reached between Tehran and world powers. And it seems as though Iran is going to embrace a neoliberal policy. I'd like to ask both of our guests about this. Mansoor Farhang is Professor Emeritus of International Relations at Bennington College in Vermont. Hadi Ghami is Executive Director of the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran, one of the leading groups reporting and documenting human rights violations in Iran. And we're talking about the details of the agreement, and we've got a question from a listener. So let's go to John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose and guests. This is an historic agreement, especially considering the fact that Russia and China are part of this agreement. It shows what can be done. However, I remain suspicious because of the problems we had with North Korea in getting their nuclear weapons. And I'm concerned about the inspections here as well. It's my understanding that there are certain places in Iran that inspectors can go anytime, anywhere, but there are other places that they need to get permission. And my question is, who holds veto power over where the inspectors can go to do their job?
All right. Thank you. Mansoor, do you know?
Well, in Iran, ultimately, it will be Ayatollah Khamenei, the chief, the supreme leader of the country. But International Atomic Energy Agency and the managers of the Iranian nuclear facilities, they have actually made, according to Mr. Salehi, who is in charge in Iran, that their agreement is actually confidential. And the reason the agreement is confidential is because if they open it up and admit to the fact that they have no choice but to open the facilities for inspection, they could face serious opposition from the radicals within Iran. So I assume that the Iranian government, with the support, with the approval of Ayatollah Khamenei, has entered into confidential agreement with International Atomic Energy Agency for inspection of the suspected facilities. That makes me hopeful that Iran is not going to be North Korea. I should add that in North Korea, Russia and China did not really support the idea. In fact, China probably was more in favor of keeping North Korea as a threat than neutralizing it. While in Iran, China and Russia do not want Iran to have the capacity to make nuclear weapons.
And also, Farhang, for years the regime repeated the mantra that nuclear energy is our unquestionable and inalienable right. So how are they explaining this to their supporters?
The energy, still they could have energy in order to, but what Iran did with respect to expansion of its nuclear facilities, particularly enrichment of uranium, it was far beyond the use of nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, but in a more general sense, which is a reality of advancement of technology. Any country that is capable of enriching uranium up to 20% is potentially capable of enriching it to 90% to make a nuclear bomb. This is a fact. Therefore, the rest of the question, even though Iran systematically denies that it has any intention to do so, but I personally do not have any doubt that Iran wanted from mid-1980s to 2003, Iran was pursuing to gain the capacity to make nuclear weapons. Now, which is fascinating story, is actually the question you raised. Mr. Salehi, who is in charge of Iranian nuclear facilities and was involved in the negotiation, he admitted the other day in a press conference that Iran has invested billions of dollars, far more than $100 billion. He said, we paid attention to the security and nationalist concerns without really thinking about the massive economic cost of this project. So they're beginning to see the massive economic investment the Iranian regime has made in the nuclear facility, a country that has oil and gas among the top natural resources of countries in the world, that it really made absolutely no economic sense from the very beginning. This program had more to do with projecting power, projecting importance, and playing a role, an expanding role in Mid-Eastern politics, than having anything to do with production of energy.
So they got nothing in return for spending more than $100 billion on this nuclear program. It was really
not
about power.
In fact, we could, and here in a repressive society, it was impossible in Iran for Iranian scientists to produce an analysis and raise some questions. What is the purpose of the incredibly expensive program? Anyone who raised those questions could end up in jail.
Hmm. We have an email from Michael who says, I have heard that military concessions are proposed to be offered to Israel as mollification for this deal. Do you know if this is true?
But you know, the United States has always assisted Israel $3 billion a year. The question is that if this question assumes that the Israeli concern is really a nuclear threat from Iran, which is far from the truth. Mr. Netanyahu and the right-wing people in Israel, they want to make Iran the number one threat and the number one enemy of the Western world in the Middle East for two reasons. One, because if the Israeli people are so preoccupied with the security concern, and the Iranian radicals and Iranian semi-fascists have been threatening destruction of Israel, and for Jewish people who have suffered for 2,000 years, someone comes and threatens their existence, it's understandable that they respond with a great deal of fear and concern. Netanyahu exaggerates that because right-wing people in Israel benefit from this threat. At the same time, when Iran is the number one enemy in the Middle East region, people are not paying attention to the Palestinian issue, where Israel is subjected to a great deal of criticism from a legal, ethical, and moral point of view. So the intention or the motive of the Israelis trying to defeat this agreement is not really threat of nuclear bomb from Iran, but elimination of Iran as the boogeyman of the region, which serves the right-wing Israelis in pursuit of their expansionist policies.
Well, thank you for that email, Michael, and thanks for the article you just sent over. We'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the Iran nuclear deal. The deal was reached on July 14th after 20 months of grueling negotiations. It's gotten so much attention, mostly from opposition. And today we are talking about how this deal will affect the Iranian people. What are the details? What about the sanctions? And then what's in store for the future of Iran? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have any questions, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this deal? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Mansour Farhang, Professor Emeritus of International Relations at Bennington College in Vermont. Hadi Ghami is Executive Director of the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran. It's one of the leading groups reporting and documenting human rights violations in Iran. And what about the sanctions? If Iran does not violate the terms of the agreement, the sanctions will be resealed. Hadi, what is the mechanism for the removal of sanctions? How do you see that playing out?
Let me first make clear that there's economic sanctions related to the nuclear activity, which Europe and U.S. have been leading in having in their national legislation and policy in place. And then there are the U.N. Security Council sanctions. And the way it is playing out, we're waiting first for the deal to be passing the hurdle of U.S. Congress. The UN Security Council has prepared to issue statements following that for lifting them on the international stage. It's going to be much more complicated in the U.S., but I think the Europeans can move faster in removing them. And the real issue is going to be the snapback situation, the snapback conditions. I think Iran will comply. It has very little reason to cheat or try to not cooperate with the agreement, because the sanctions are going to take time to come off. I don't think in 2015 there would be much benefit. The very first benefit is going to be on freezing of Iranian assets around the world, which, if the agreement goes through, will give some cash to the government, which is very cash-starved. And then specific sanctions will start to be removed probably in 2016. Again, I don't think Iran has much interest to not comply, because the sanctions are going to be lifted in stages, and for 20 months we have seen them. They have been cooperating with the terms of the temporary joint plan of action that was in place, and the Iranian people are very eager to see economic rehabilitation of the country. They have suffered a lot. And yet, people who argue that a better deal would have kept the sanctions in place and even increased them to really bring the government or the regime to its knees, I think are their analysis is misplaced. Iran, even now, every journalist and visitor to the country says that there is really no shortage of goods or services in the country. The issue is that the middle class and the bulk of the population has no economic ability to really have a normal life with its purchasing power. But there is a tiny fraction of population that has become super rich and is the consumer of luxury goods and other goods. So people are very, very much waiting to see the positive impact of the sanctions once they begin to be lifted, but just lifting the sanction not going to resolve their problems. Half of the problem resides inside Iran with corruption and government graft, and we now only learning that under Ahmadinejad, when oil was at the height of its price at $120 a barrel and the government's budget was huge, there was also huge corruption and theft going on at the highest level of government. So people hope the sanctions would be lifted, and at the same time Rouhani government would ensure that the new money will not be wasted the way that it has been previously, and indeed will be channeled toward productive segments of economy. One group of people is going to play a very important role is the international business, who are very, very interested. We already see huge delegations of even American CEOs visiting the country, and they will have an important role in creating employment, especially in the country. But as Mansour mentioned, we got to make sure that these business interlocutors do put human rights concerns on the top of their agenda. They are even more important than the United Nations member states or governments in compelling the Iranian government to compromise and change its domestic policies. And especially companies in Silicon Valley like Google and Apple, who are already talking to Iranian government, can play a very major role in lifting the repressive policies in place.
And, you know, we'll talk about that in a minute. But since you were talking about the super rich and the middle class, I also wanted to talk about people living in poverty. Is it true that about 40% of the population is living in poverty in Iran?
According to government's own statistics, yes, most of the working class is below the official poverty line. What has been very disconcerting for the working class in Iran is the trend that there is really no more full-time employment and benefits. 90% of hires in Iran are done on basically contract basis, so people don't get any benefits or long-term employment guarantees. These contracts are renewed every 6 months or a year, and that has really caused a lot of hardship. And at the same time, pretty much the entire manufacturing sector has shut down because they don't have access to financial markets. They can't import the necessary equipment they need or goods they need. So the working class is suffering a huge unemployment, facing inflation, and as a result, so many of them are living under poverty line. It's a combination of international sanctions, domestic business practices, and government corruption.
And Hadi, how do you think the lifting of sanctions will affect people living in poverty?
Well, I'm hoping that it will provide opportunities for the private sector to increase its productivity. Right now, money in Iran is pretty much circulated in non-productive sectors like and speculative sectors, especially the real estate. Real estate sector doesn't really provide that much employment opportunities. Iran is very young, very educated. Rouhani government recognizes the number of unemployed youth who have higher education degrees, and we need, especially like the technology sector, going to be one of the ones that can really flourish. And that's why I say companies like Google and Apple may be really important players for the government to invest in the country. And the Iranian-American community is very wealthy and has a lot of resources and can bring its professionalism and ability to create companies and jobs inside the country. So I think the lifting of the sanctions, you see, Iran right now is completely shut off from financial markets. When you're out of the banking system, it's just impossible to be having international business operating there. Once that is lifted, that could create a lot of employment opportunities, provided that the government puts in place proper policies and makes sure that the money is not wasted on corruption and graft.
That is Hadi Ghami. He's executive director of the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran, one of the leading groups reporting and documenting human rights violations in Iran. We're also joined by Mansour Farhang, professor emeritus of international relations at Bennington College. Today we're talking about the Iran nuclear deal, the details, how it affects the Iranian people, and then what happens if the Iranian economy is open to foreign oil companies, for example, technology companies. And if you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Mansour, what do you make of the economic model Iran seems to be embracing? They seem to be going neoliberal. Iran will be joining the World Trade Organization. Reuters has had some really good pieces calling the investment packages Iran was offering in that Vienna conference I mentioned that took place last week as, quote, strikingly pro-market. Many of the policies would not have been out of place in a center-right European government, end quote. What do you make of that?
But Iran has always been interested in pro-market, except that who controls the market? Iran is a rentier state. That is, the major source of income in the country comes from oil export, and the government completely controls that. The government is deeply corrupt, and particularly in this regime, the family connection, that is, therefore, the Iranian economy over the past 30-some years has become a kind of semi-feudal economy, that people getting rich, it means they have close ties and connection with people who control resources in the government. Now, this division within the Iranian regime, which is not some similarities with what we saw, for example, in China following the death of, you know, Mao Zedong, that there are elements within Iran who are questioning this system that has been operating, that is, this I describe it as a semi-feudal economy, and even though they use populistic vocabulary, they sound very egalitarian, but when it comes to social justice, when it comes to economic equity, the Iranian regime is immensely reactionary. So I'm not so sure if even the end of confrontation between the U.S. and Iran or the Western world then is going to change the domestic policies of the Iranian regime. It takes much more a structural change inside the country. There is a struggle going on, and it will ultimately be to to a socio-political movement within the country that can demand a structural and fundamental changes before the Iranian people can actually benefit from any policy that in an equitable fashion. Otherwise, even the end of the sanctions, the end of this confrontation will not necessarily lead to a more equitable economic order in Iran. It's really, the situation is not open enough for dissident elements to create organizations or for entrepreneurs who are not connected with the government to engage in economic activities. But ending this confrontation creates hope in a movement toward a more equitable Iran. How long it will take, in what way it will happen, we don't know. But at the present time, what the international companies, as Hadi was saying, Iran is going to be desperate in making connections with major corporations in Western Europe and the United States to invest in Iran and to have regular trade relationship with Iran. This vulnerability of the Iranian regime, I hope, will be used by international entrepreneurs to demand some change in Iran domestic civil and human rights policies. If that happens, it could definitely create the kind of social movement that would generate a movement for economic justice. In the absence of a degree of openness and the possibility of open political activity, it is very difficult to expect the Iranian regime to make any change in the direction of economic equity and economic justice.
The New York Times reports that executives from Royal Dutch Shell, Total, and Eni, ENI, met with Iran's oil minister in Vienna in June, and there have been other meetings in Tehran in recent months. And then Reuters is reporting on the potential privatization of, for example, hospitals, schools, and highways. Parliament has given permission for the sale of assets or projects such as hospitals, schools, and highways. Mansour, what are your thoughts on that?
But these are very detailed questions that only one with information about economic situation could respond to that. But still, we are talking about Iranian economic elite engaging in negotiation, interaction, or effort to attract foreign investment and foreign capital. When Rouhani came to power, it was incredible that for the first time, the president of the country said, in order to solve our economic problems, we need to have a normal trade relationship with the rest of the world, particularly Western Europe and America, and also try to attract foreign investment inside the country. Now, is this something that only the elite can do, only the privileged elite can benefit from, or the society will open up so that other entrepreneurs, labor organizations, teachers, and social and other people who work, members of groups in the workforce can participate? It's very hard to tell what will happen in Iran as a result of this deal. But there is hope in Iran that this deal will pave the way for such a possibility. Mm.
I want to end, we have a couple more minutes left, on, again, what this means for human rights. And when people in Tehran were celebrating on the streets when this deal was announced, some reported that there were crackdowns. And then also in some places, people were shouting slogans demanding the release of Green Movement leaders who have been under house arrest for the past couple of years. This didn't get much attention. Hadi, what else didn't get much attention? What else do we need to know about crackdowns and how the regime is responding to the public?
Right. The couple of weeks leading to the signing of the agreement was quite fascinating inside Iran, actually, because there was a deadline of June 30th that became clear will not be met, and then every day there were news that there may or may not be a deal. But the build-up toward that deadline had created a lot of excitement inside the country. And there was much talk in the media and social networks about celebrating the nuclear deal. And there were expectations. We know that throughout the various segments of the society, there is huge support for this deal. So there was a potential that as the news of the signing of the deal comes in, there could be huge celebrations and hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. And that really alarmed the hardliners and intelligence services. So they came out very strongly and started giving out directives that there should be no celebrations, no public demonstration in support of the deal. And, you know, they justified it on different grounds. Some said that, well, the deal is not final. It still has to go through U.S. Congress and other obstacles. Therefore, no celebration is called for. And, of course, the more hardline opponents of the deal said, this is really a defeat and a national disaster. We're giving up much of our nuclear infrastructure and leverage. What is there to celebrate? But the key point is that there was a strong message from the state agencies and organs that control the domestic repression to the general population that don't dare to make a large noise once this news comes out. Regardless, we did see on that evening many demonstrations throughout the country, and the key point that was really fascinating for me was, again, what you mentioned, much of the chanting that we received in audio-video format documented was calling for release of Green Movement leaders, and then another one was a very interesting chant which said, our next agreement is an agreement on civil liberties. Mm-hmm. So people were very vocally on the streets making it clear that after the nuclear negotiation, they want the attention to be turned to the domestic situation and improvement of human rights. And that in action, we have seen, unfortunately, especially the judiciary and intelligence services continuing their crackdown. There are people every day being sentenced to very lengthy prison terms simply for a Facebook posting or writing an article or being critical. One thing that has gone completely unreported, unfortunately.
And we have just about 10 seconds.
Executions. Executions have spiked humongously in the past 6 months, and that is a major concern, too.
Wow. Hadi Ghami is Executive Director of the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran. Mansour Farhang is Professor Emeritus of International Relations at Bennington College in Vermont. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How far have we come in creating safety and respect for marine mammals? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Rick O'Berry, former flipper trainer turned dolphin activist and star of the Academy Award-winning documentary The Cove. The Dolphin Project works to end the billion-dollar dolphin captivity industry and end the killing of dolphins in Japan. We're seeing an unprecedented level of backlash against SeaWorld, but the dolphin trade is increasing abroad. So what's next for marine mammals? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.